On my 11th birthday, 41 years ago, I leapt fully clothed into the Thames. My father rescued me easily, of course, but I couldn't tell him why I'd done it, because I hadn't got a clue. This memory has come back now because my father died suddenly this morning, and out of the 365 possibilities, today happens to be the 11th birthday of my own son. But I've driven straight down to be here in my parents' house, not up country to my son. If I'm absolutely honest, I hadn't planned on being with him anyway. It didn't fit in. At supper, I picked at some fish. My mother ate nothing. I parked her in front of the TV and come into Dad's study to rummage and remember. I'm desolate, of course, but also frustrated. Dad and I were ever scrappy in our dealings, and now the chance to tidy things up has gone for good. I look in his desk and find an envelope addressed to me. I open it and find two wristwatches, as gleaming new as the day they vanished. Once they were notorious. I haven't had sight of them since that winter of my discontent when I jumped into the Thames. The winter of my many outrages. Sigmund Freud, inventor of that parlor game Hunt the Symbol, had an explanation for what I was up to. Apparently it's the eldest son's dream of killing father, then getting rid of rivalrous siblings, and finally marrying mother. Over-geometric to my mind, but if Freud was correct, my dream should come true today, what with both my siblings not arrived yet, and mother and myself alone together. Right. Have a look at me as I was, 41 years ago, aged 11. Physical character, small, but very fast. Mental character, 50,000 volts, do not touch. Spiritual character, a roller coaster of want, need, and greed. One freezing morning, shortly before Christmas, when my bad behavior was off the Richter scale altogether, Dad said, "You and I are going to get to the bottom of all this, my lad, even if it kills us. For a week, it will be just him and me." Maman, brother and sister were swanning off to Paris, all expenses paid by French Grande Maman, a quiet lady who lived near the Bois de Boulogne with her war veteran husband, whose mind was still fighting a losing battle in the trenches of the Somme. Anyway, my strict orders were to stay at home with Dad. That December morning, then, plump Mr. Allibone arrived in his plump Austin Somerset saloon to chauffeur the lucky trio up to Victoria Station to catch the Golden Arrow train, with its attendants waiting in the chocolate and cream Pullmans to serve them Welsh rarebit or baked beans upon, yes, upon toast. Tray, tray, posh. Dad gathered suitcases. Mr. Allibone loaded them. Goodbyes were lavished. Maman tried, without luck, to plant a kiss on me. "Be good, mon petit chou." Little cabbage, as always. I bargained. "Bring me back something special." Hands waved from the Austin. So, it would be me versus Dad, with occasional breaks when he went to take net practice in the grammar school gym. The whole world admired him, a talented cricketer and teacher extraordinaire. Now began the patient negotiations. Dad tried to tease explanations out of me, starting with my smallest peccadilloes. The tampering with Mrs. Sinclair's milk bottles. The bricks through Mr. Rodzinski's glass house, ruining that Polish refugee's livelihood. What had I got to say? All foreigners, especially mothers, should go home, I flung over my shoulder as I bolted, legs going like the Flying Scotsman. A timely exit, as we'd have got on to last month's fire at Cuthman's Hotel. Once in the high street, my fingers itched to steal. In Woolworths, I did three exercise books and a girl's cardigan, all of which I dumped, and 10 Woodbines, all of which I smoked. Later, to conclude the thieving imagery, I stole home and vomited. During a truce with Dad, I asked what presents I'd be getting from Paris. A watch which Maman was bringing back, but, big but, strict conditions applied. I'd have it for Christmas Day only. Then it would be put in Dad's private Fort Knox until, 1, I mended my ways, 2, I passed the 11 plus. Then, and only then, the watch would be mine for keeps. Dodgy psychology. From that moment on, of course, I became obsessed with the thing. Maman and siblings returned from Paris on Christmas Eve. Dad and I met them at the station. Dad kissed Maman, picked up brother and sister, one in each arm, and they started for home. I trailed behind, kicking objects. Christmas morning. Presents. Sister got her dress, which will only make her 10 million admirers find her 10 million times more delicious. Everyone thought she was the cat's pyjamas. Talking of which, she got her snow white kitten, too. Immediately christened Nelson because of the black patch of fur around one eye. Brother went into happy orbit about his pint-sized violin, which would be the envy of his London Academy for budding geniuses. At last, the watch. Maman handed me a small box. My chest went thump-thump. On a bed of blue satin was a gold Omega, deep glowing treasure. The dial was like pearl. The raised numerals, tiny sculptures. Green hands shone. The strap was soft. Go on, monsieur, Maman smiled. Put it on. I did. I was Cinderella, until clocks struck and the watch vanished. By Boxing Day, I'd had enough of tweeting brother and sister. I'd had enough of meowing cat and meowing cat gut. When brother settled on the lav, I locked him in and nabbed his precious violin. He didn't notice, lost in his rendition of Brahms' Third Symphony, which was flying upwards from his small and busy mouth. I edged out of the house, jumped on the violin from a great height, and hurled the remains into next door's garden. Mrs. Penfold was there talking to the birds, as usual, and when she saw it was me, she said, "Not you again," and marched over to our house. I scarpered to the disused air raid shelter where I'd established a camp. When darkness fell, I crept back. Dad's verdict was that, since it was the festive season, I'd be let off with, 1, apologies to Mrs. Penfold and brother, 2, repayment of violin on a drip feed system. A couple of weeks elapsed, and then it was the turn of Nelson, the one-eyed cat. He had to go. I love little pussy, his coat is so warm, literally, as I did my best to torch him. You wait till that your father come home. I didn't wait. I was out of the bedroom window, down a drainpipe, then up and away like an Olympic final, straight back to school in time for afternoon lessons. In came the headmaster. He'd obviously heard. My office, he barked. Good luck, the class whispered. All that night I remained in my camp, sobbing, my satchel for a pillow. Next morning my posterior had turned down, but my anger swirled like a helicopter. I didn't go home or to school. Instead, I shinned up a big tree near the prefabs, the tree with telegraph wires running through its high branches. I perched, waiting for Steve Grover, Colin Harrison and the rest to pass by below. Hey, the police are out looking for you, Steve called up. Who cares? A black Riley Pathfinder swept up. Out jumped PC Bettany. We knew each other well. He commanded me to come down. Make me, I said. He began to climb, but I edged out on a branch and launched myself into space. In full view of the assembled crowds below, I started to swing on a telegraph wire, waving and laughing my head off. Dad arrived in cricket gear. He reasoned with me. The cat was fine, just a bit of singed fur. A fire engine poked its ladder up. I was snatched, bundled into the Riley and taken straight to the police station. Dad asked Sergeant Fowler to arrest me. Those very words. Arrest him, please. Huh, I said inside myself. Huh. Sergeant Fowler sighed and took me to a back room and told me to sit. Doctor's going to see you first, he said, handing me a biscuit. Dr. Prothero arrived, checked me over, pronounced me unharmed. The telegraph wire couldn't have been live, he added. Well, that was obvious. Then Sergeant Fowler said that one more trick like that and it would be Borstal, and he wouldn't lift another finger to help me. Had I understood? Yes. Okay. Slingy Rook. I went off the boil for a bit. But the Omega watch glowed green in my imagination. I was building up to something drastic. That something was to creep off one midnight to Accrington's, the High Street jewellers, and put a quick brick through their window. I grabbed a watch. Any. A chrome and plastic Newmark, as it turned out. Cudgel hands, tick like a mallet. I took off at 120 miles per hour. Once back in my room, however, I was blasted by the twin barrels of awful truth. First, I'd never be able to show off this new mark, not at home, not at school, not anywhere. All I could ever do was croon and swoon in secret while the world slept. Then, secondly, this gem was in fact nothing more than fairground tat, not worth showing off to anyone. So next day, I wrapped it up and buried it. Sad as Sunday, I drifted home. But the sap soon rose again. Time for a new campaign. I collected Neil's replacement violin and Dad's beloved cricket bat. Luckily for the cat, I couldn't find him. I climbed down the railway cutting, placed bat, violin, plus several stones on the rails, climbed back up onto the road bridge, and waited for the Atlantic Coast Express, non-stop Waterloo to the west. It approached, steam billowing from its streamlined engine with a whistle deep as Kathleen Ferrier's Middle Sea. As it streaked under the bridge, I made a dash for the other side. I don't know what it was I was expecting, I really don't. Spectacular crash, possibly. But I ask you. A child's fiddle, a strip of willow and a scatter of pebbles versus 500 tons of thundering express train. Well, there was a crash. In the blanket of steam, a lorry hit me. When I regained consciousness, I was in my bed. Maman was anguished. Dad's face was as long as a coffee pot. Dr. Prothero held up one finger and asked how many I could see. Too many. An ambulance took me away. An X-ray showed a fracture of the skull. I'd have to stay in hospital for a month. Which I did. Meek as a lamb. I don't know if it was the bang on the head, but from that moment I became the model son. Later, standing in the inevitable juvenile court, bandaged like Siegfried Sassoon, I willingly accepted my 2 years of probation. Dad insisted on paying Accrington's not only for the stolen Newmark, which had been unearthed, but also for the smashed window. I worked like crazy for the 11-plus exam, and failed. Absolutely no question that I'd be allowed either of the two watchers. Rules were rules. But Dad did arrange for me to have a special interview with his headmaster. I was serious and polite, and on the 8th of September was accepted into the bottom class at the grammar school, from which I soon rose, never to look back. I suppose we are all inhabited by different selves, struggling for supremacy. Eventually, most of them give up. I thought my pubescent demons were dead. But 41 years on, back in my childhood house, here they go again. Hurl bricks, derail trains, set fire to defenseless animals. But I'm troubled by the image, on the far side of my nostalgia, of my little son, stuck up there in his school, blowing out 11 candles on his own. I pick up the two watches, go back into the lounge. I place a hand on my mother's shoulder. Oh, I must have been dozing off. I show her the watches. Remember these? Yes, she says. Your father and I often talked about that time. She rises in stages from her chair and switches off the television. You are such a strange little boy, monsieur. We were both worried so sick about you. I wonder if you ever have known how much. I smile. I think I'm beginning to. I put the watches in my pocket and offer Mother my arm. Tomorrow I'm fetching my brother and sister from the station. But first thing, before anything else, I shall phone my son.
11 Plus by Martin Sorrell was read by John Bramwell. The producer was Melanie Harris.